Kia ora he uri tēnei o Te Atiawa me Taranaki, ko Alistair Puna Somerville Lahau. I teach at the Faculty of Māori and Indigenous Studies at the University of Waikato, and one of the great joys of the last 3 years of my life has been a Marsden-funded project called Writing the New World, Indigenous Texts 1900 to 1975.
Kala whanawa, I'm Wanda Jeremiah Allen, your podcast host. Welcome to Writing the New World podcast. This is a special edition titled Poetry, Language, Archives, Three Indigenous Poets. It is a special edition recorded for the 2020 New Zealand Poetry Day. Enjoy, and make sure you hit up our Facebook, Twitter, and podcast domains for more incredible discussions on Indigenous literatures.
Kia ora, ko Esme Ranapiri tōku ingoa. My name is Esme Ranapiri, and I'm a poet.
Nā e Māori, I'm Mira Taito, and I'm a poet too.
Kia ora, I'm Alice Te Punga Somerville. Usually in my biographies, I say she also writes an occasional poem, but today I'll say I'm a poet.
Homework. Ngā ruene rako ne vēla re e hanueta. If you want to know what's for dinner, ka is omoe tese. Reach above you with your left hand, feel around the spider poo and exoskeletons for your grandmother's words. Fill your fist with umlauts and glottal stops until you see a blue vein pulsing on your wrist. E o koko ne siu. Lower your hand, unwrap your fist, one finger at a time. Swallow your find. Tortene e po. If you want me to pass you the salt, nam sesta fingalele, shove your pudgy right hand between the ornament cupboard and TV stand, make another fist, nonus hoi ak, start again, re hoi ak, re akwo. That was the first poem. And I'll read the second one, eh? Broken introduction. I leap off a chair to show you that I'm falling. I flutter my fingers as I jump to show you that I'm a leaf falling. I headbang and send my hair into mayhem to show you that I can fall wild like a grunge rock fan. But you confuse me for a storm, and we cannot have that. So let me start again. I am autumn. Ngole. I am a child of spring and summer. Ngole on. Ma. My sister is winter. Ota sosyong henta le. I'm older. Ngota mafue. I'm infinity years old. Ngofo. I live in the northern and southern hemisphere. Ngo noh e ma. Now your turn. Whose child are you? Kai le on say. Reveal yourself in staggered truths. And for the sake of the leaves, spare me your confusing storms too. That's my two.
So cool. I have two poems. This first one's called Into the Teeth of the Gale for Turongo. You take up the wood of your house and spill it into the sea. The bodies of your ancestors gone swimming back to Hawaiki. You throw your home into the water to raft your past to some distant star as it sinks into the horizon. You stand on the dune, windswept, chanting grief at the blind gale. What do you see on that white line between blue bodies? You are at war with the silence in yourself. You see a weight that only Tane could lift. Determined not to slip, you dig toes into the sand. This poem is called Where is the Thread, or Where the Thread Is. Under desk, here is silence, or what can you hear? Are you here under the desk haunting the carpet, Tūranga Waiwai, on cement piles? We must be buried there somewhere. One metal tine at a time, tweeze the individual strands up from the ground. Where is the ground? Where is the ground when, inside a machine made of zeros and ones, can you hear our tūpuna whir inside each pixel? Does each megabyte make something shine or otherwise? If a question could be asked of us, I would ask it. What does the shape of the whole thing look like? When the mist recedes, it leaves red marks. The string is taut, about to break, but the tension makes a kind of music, a dirge or a waiata, the sun glancing of coils, or a kicked dog in the kennel out back. They make up so many stories about them that no one believes they're real, unfed or fed on a great absence or a great potential. Could you bark to get them talking again, their stories in the trees, wrapped in feather, wrapped in leaf, rays push through the canopy, my eyes pushing through, a million different ways to sell us assimilation. There is a child calling in the dark, with her voice crackling over whisper, but I can make it out. It already sounds familiar. If I could say hello again and again, I would. We would have a conversation of greetings of, you are there, I see you, there, on a screen, on a replica of paper, and we would see that the flat surface isn't so flat, like a river. Travelling back, we finally land on the same beach and start writing on the same clouds. Now I can see the marks you've left in the air, lines in all directions, feel them brushing, reeds against the inside of my lungs, so many threads, turned in so many hands, bristling at my throat as they grow and spread branches through my body. They give off a light, and I've found you, at last. There you are in bones, where there is silence, where there is no silence at all. We sing, we all sing.
So cool.
Mm. I'm so goosebumps. I'm like, oh my god.
Reading
voice. Plus, you've got really good eyes.
No, I mean, really small. I was like, wow.
Yeah.
You should have my age here.
I was trying to fit it on one page.
It's
quite small, but.
Really cool.
It led to the, you know, searching for something feeling.
That's right. So I've got four poems that connect to the archive stuff. The first one is called Freya Library UQ.
Some days you sit in an air-conditioned archive working your way through boxes of paper underneath a picture of David Unaipon, and you don't feel as lonely in this university place as you have felt in others surrounded by people. And my other three poems connect to three different people that are writers that I've been looking at in the project. So first draft of A Waiatatangi is for Tirangi Hiroa. It's hot here, without electric fan, open window, bare legs, I'd be lying in the dark, heavy-limbed and drowsy. As it is, I can feel an ache of warmth at the back of my neck, where hair falls in a tight curtain around an already moist little nook. I'm lying on my tummy, skin pressing into a warm patch of blanket, working on the first draft of something I'll never finish. Although warm milk and sheets are supplied at night time to wide-awake children in the islands of our births, warmth has the opposite effect here. It's too hot to fall quickly to sleep tonight. I visited your whare, Te Pātaka o Pihopa, today. Before heading to the archive at the back of the building, I walked through front doors, upstairs, over carpet, to greet the small Māori display at the end of the mezzanine. Laid a handful of leaves beside the whakaero there, quietly sang to them under my breath, a small one-sided karanga surprising the other occupants more than the other visitors. I wondered if you used to visit these cabinets too, if you looked across the carpet as I did and felt them looking back, appraising, gluing feet to floor and tumbling body into air all at the same time. I walked along corridors you paced for years, a precise producer of catalogues, a scientist working with the test tubes and Bunsen burners of culture before it was embarrassing to treat people like lab rats, to steal things and ideas for safekeeping on air-conditioned shelves. The relief it must have been to return here after your last trip home, but also the grief. Did you visit the whakaero more or less after your final wrenching? Does spending time with those things of our own provide solace or discomfort? Do things behind glass feel enclosed, cut off, pristine, or do they keep you company? E te rangihiroa, still hot, still sticky, was it like this the night you died? I wonder if you felt more at home as your body turned cold after last breaths. I wonder if your wairua found a path to follow to Hawaiki, departing as it did from this wrong end of our marvellous watery hemisphere. Sorry, my poem's all depressing as. And they're going down. I wrote this one the morning that I just heard that Alistair Tereke Campbell had passed away.
Oh,
and I'd just been lecturing about him about 2 days before that. It's called Te Ariki. Go now, e Te Ariki, to your mates, your beloved, your blood. Let those hands which held all those pens, magicked a thousand words, lie still and empty at last. Go back home, with no return ticket this time. Spend no more nights dreaming of an infancy in the sun. Your mother has been waiting for you. Go the way your friends have gone. The tracks may still be warm from Hone's recent journey. You've been one of us on these rugged frozen isles since arriving with a luggage tag on your small boy's jacket all those years ago. You and your brother fighting alongside us since before we can remember, one in the 28th, the other on pages. The least we can do is loan you a pathway home. No longer perch on the edge of these cliffs with an eye on the tide. Follow sand to water. Leave us behind. Go. Alistair Te Ariki Campbell, firsts and firsts, accomplishments, and now you've breathed your last.
Thank you.
Sorry, guys. I might not get through this one, but I'll give it a whirl. It's called Sphere for My Lockdown Baby. And this responds to a line from a Jackie Stern poem, The Planet is an Urupa. I am a planet, my tides, my orbit, my atmosphere, my seasons, my poles, my girth. When I saw the pulse on the screen, a heartbeat deep in my womb, you became my ruomoho, shaking everything, nausea, vertigo, vomit, sleep. 3 days after we buried you at home, in a box with a butterfly on its lid, I felt the deep rumble and sharp jolt of that unborn child, still tucked inside its mother. Yes, I am jealous of Papatuanuku, who despite everything, at least still has her child. I am a planet, swirling oceans, sharp rock, a molten core. I'm a planet longing to be in the sweet spot between too cold and too hot for life. I am an urupa full of whakapapa, full of death, quiet, a place to mourn the hearts that used to beat here. See, I told you mine were a buzz cable.
The one that you wrote for Alistair online. Oh, yeah. It's published somewhere, isn't it?
I put it on Facebook, actually. That was how I actually let people know that it had been that he'd passed away. And as soon as I heard, I just sat down and wrote that and then sent it to my students that I'd just been telling about him.
Yeah.
And I can't remember if I published it anywhere. Yeah. Mm-hmm. But I think it circulated a little bit when I wrote it.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
So I've never heard. So this is the first time you're reading Sphere, or you read it?
Oh, yeah, I just wrote it.
Like,
I
just...
A couple weeks ago.
Oh.
Yeah. Yeah. First time I've read it outside of my head.
Oh. Real honour to
hear. Yes. If I ever see it out in the world in a journal, I will remember this day.
Absolutely.
I mean, it's one of those things, though, eh, that, that sometimes, you know, while I've been working on the project, it's been like, oh, we're reading this stuff because it was very important for telling us about the time and stuff. But I think one of the things that really struck me, especially with, in that case, Jackie Stern's, you know, line, is that actually the stuff there, it's still, you know, it has the capacity to reach us and help us frame our own very contemporary experiences, right? I mean, that's what I feel about, you know, your poems about the, you know, it's kind of this... like reaching across time thing, but it's not just, it's a two-way reaching, eh?
Yes.
So we can edit that one out for our tears if we feel like it. Yeah,
that waterproof
camera. No, you were all choking.
Thanks,
you should
jealous.
Never invite me to a poetry reading, I'll kill the mood.
Oh. Oh my gosh.
I think she meant that nicely.
There's like a lot of, I found a lot of relief going through Te Aho, because it's like all these things that I've been like trying to grapple with and feeling like I had to start talking about them, but then I found all this work that, you know, has already open that door.
Mm.
And so it's like, oh, I don't have to start from...
Don't have to do all the jobs, eh? Like, yeah.
And it's just like, still things that are just... There's things that are relevant for, like, good reasons and things that are relevant for, you know, negative ones. Because things may change, but they... Yeah, progress is slow.
Yeah.
But, you know, in terms of the project and what you guys are doing, I also, my connection is the text in our language.
Yeah.
For me, and I remember seeing Rongo Rongo for the first time during Rotuma Language Week when we had, when Fisiutu Solomone, who is just this amazing, oh my God, I'm going to listen to her this afternoon. She organized an evening with the archives, and that's when I first learned of Rongo Rongo, and that's when I saw the Rotuman text, you know, all those years ago. And whenever I see that, and for me, it's kind of an inspiration in the sense that, you know, I actually talked about my struggle at home, which is what homework is about, in trying to transmit it to my 12-year-old, which is so hard, so hard. And then I see the writing in Rotuman of people in our past, our ancestors, who have written, and who the language is there. So I see the text as saying to me, don't give up. The language is here. You know, take solace from the fact that you're not alone. And it takes years to be able to do what you're trying to do with one little boy, let alone a whole community. So Rongo Rongo and all this text that you people are pulling out, even in especially with the different languages, has that effect on me. It's like the language talking to me through this text, saying, hang in there, nonus hoek, you know, do it again, just keep doing it, start again. Should you fall, I mean, every English word that comes out of your mouth in your house, start again. So this is my emotional connection to the project and all the texts that you're finding in our languages. So well done, keep going, no nus hoek, make another fist, do it again.
Yeah, so one of the things that struck me about homework is that homework as a term is so schoolish, eh? And it's like the imposition of the educational institutions into our homes.
Yes.
And then the homework that we end up having to do as Indigenous people, we have to do because of the imposition of the schools into our mouths, right? Yes. And that kind of, that weirdness that we now have to, like, set up a context where we're like doing homework within our own family context, right? Because of those places that we associate with that term homework, right?
Yeah.
And so we end up having to create this like fakety fake school environment. Do you know what I mean? Just like, you know, it's just the worst insult. It's like, okay, so the school system, the external, the things outside the home.
Yes.
That are the whole reason we have to go through this, like, embarrassing, humiliating journey together.
Yes.
You know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I remember trying to translate that word, the word homework, and what it actually means.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, I tried, and I said, no, I don't know how to say this in Rotuman. So I contacted Sarote Erisito, who's just been this amazing, fantastic language guru that I go to in asking her things about the Rotuman language, and she came up with the translation, which is Ngarua Nerako, which is the work of school that you do at home. But she was translating it in the way that we know homework as in what we bring from the described. And sometimes for me, in terms of teaching Lapuke, the language, and this is probably where the problem is. This is, I teach him so formally when the language should be done so organically and naturally in the house. And then I pull out this worksheet and I send him to these online classes, which is like homework.
Yeah, yeah, you know? Yeah, yeah.
But it's the organic work of the language at home that is so hard to do when your partner is, you know, from another culture and you're trying to exist between these two at home. And the language, my God, if the language could talk to me, it would probably say, "You are so confusing. I don't know what you're doing with me in this house. You keep switching me to English and then back to Rutuman." So it's very hard for it to grow organically in the non-homework way. Yes, but in that sense, it's also work that you need to do in the home. Language is work that you need to first start in the home. But man, it's tough. I will never ever say that it's a very easy thing to do. It's hard, especially when you're alone. And so you keep going to these sources, and there are sources that are documents. I wouldn't say artificial sources, but you don't have the people around you who know the language just falls from their mouth so naturally. So Lapuke's exposure to the language is very homeworky. You know, it's very homeworky and it's not organic. And my God, nonusho ek, make another fist. All the time. I don't know. You probably know what I mean.
Absolutely. I tend to find that the Samoan that I'm talking to my children with is instructional Samoan. So it's not necessarily conversational Samoan.
No,
it's really to do with that parent-child dynamic.
Yes.
So it's a lot to do with those sort of dynamics rather than, like you're saying, so the organic where it's conversational, you're in a particular equal footing, we can share. So yes, I think there's, in terms of culture, there's certain other barriers or other particular parameters that one needs to navigate, and that's where I find myself lost. So I definitely I definitely understand. And
it's very similar to mine. My language at home is very instructional. Lalahom. This, go and bring this, go and bring that, you know, go and do this, go and do that. It's not, how was your day? What happened? Not that kind of how are you feeling? Oh no, we are so far away from that.
But we'll get there.
We'll
get there.
And I'm imagining now the anthology of Indigenous poets. They have all written a poem, and the title is "If This Language Could Speak to Me, This Is What It Would Say." There's like that phrase that you said. I'm like, wow, you know, just think about the language as something which has the capacity to speak
to you, speak back to you.
You know, I mean, that's what it is, and that just gives me a new little like.
just imagining the language saying, "I know we're on Māori time, but."
That's right. Sometimes I imagine the language picking up a broom and coming to me and saying, not doing it properly. The language actually talking to you, shaking a broom at you. No. So when you see, I'm in this project, coming back to the project, and when you see text written in your languages from people in the past, that is. It's reassuring, it's comforting to know the language is there. It's not dead. It's not, you know, the UNESCO has this thing about the Rutuman language being vulnerable and close to extinction. And when that came out, I mean, everybody was running around with, you know, like, the word endangerment is so mischievous and problematic and creates all these, the sky is falling, the sky is falling, do something. When in actual fact, the language is very healthy in certain pockets. So the word endangerment doesn't really fully describe the state of the language. I mean, that's how I feel. Of course, I mean, it's not doing well in diaspora. It's struggling somewhat in Fiji, but it's so healthy in the islands. The children, every child on the island can speak Rutuman. Organically,
not just instruction.
not instructionally. They can speak. But Alice, you must, you probably will experience the same thing because you've got three languages now in your house.
If no, those languages could speak.
Oh my God. Growing up in, yes, a home with three languages. We have two.
three languages. Yeah. Well, you know how it is. There's like the... There's the big plans and the theories and the political commitments and the, you know. And then there's the day-to-day and you go to bed at night and you go, wow, I didn't actually speak much Māori today to this kid, or, you know. And
after imagining what language would say to each of our poets, the discussion shifts to the challenges and the joys of multilingual learning in the home. Our poets discuss the assumptions we make of each other's Indigenous learning pathways and the joys of creating important conditions for learning engagement.
I had never... Because I experience him as a fully bilingual person.
Yes.
It had never occurred to me to ask him, when did you learn English? And he learned English as a 5 or 6 year old going to school.
Yes.
Yeah. And so his concept of you can become bilingual if you start at that age, you know.
Yes.
Was totally an unspoken assumption that we both had, which was different from each other. So his was, yeah, you can start it, you know. So he's like, it's fine, she's got English, and then we'll add Fijian. And I'm like, it's not fine that there is a bilingualism as such. And, you know, there's like little parts of her brain that is not developing in the neurological blah, blah. Do you know what I mean? And I never understood, like, I knew that he's like fully committed to her being a Fijian speaker. And I'm like, and as someone who's not a Māori speaker and hasn't grown up being a Māori speaker, I know what it's like to be left at the door of so many conversations.
Oh, yes.
And you actually, it's always funny, people are always like, oh man, how do you sit through like Fiji language church services or when you go, you know, whatever. I'm like, I've spent a lot of my life sitting in contexts where people aren't speaking a language I understand. And that's every time I go to the marae. So we both had this like really strong commitment to her being trilingual. We just had completely different assumptions about the starting point for those things. It's actually a really useful conversation for us because I kind of thought Vula was slacking on what I wanted to happen, and he was, you know, and I'm like, how can you? I was like, you're so selfish. You have access to a whole world. And you're not giving that to her. And look at me. You know what pain that's going to cause. You know, I'm like, you know, blaming him for her future trips to Dr. Phil. And Dr. Pitipi. And, you know, and the reality is that we just had really different experiences of language. That meant actually totally both on the same, you know, same cope up about really different tracks.
Yes.
So it's been interesting. You know, I think, and I remember finding this with my nephew too, and my sister and I were raising our nephew, and it was really important to us that he spoke Māori as well. And we'd heard this like this domain theory. I don't know if you've heard it. There's this theory that you concentrate really hard on there being particular parts of your life that you always speak Māori then or whatever, so that it doesn't just become instructional. Whenever we are at the table or in the car or whatever. So we were like, okay, Tuesdays are going to be Māori. Oh my God, me and my sister talk all the time, and we would have these really quiet Tuesdays, you know, because we didn't have the, you know, the ability to say much more than just transactional stuff. We'd like these really quiet drives to, you know, school in the mornings or whatever. I think it's complicated, but that's thinking about this idea of our languages, you know, chasing us with a broom, but my desire is for my language to come and give me a hug, right? That's my desire.
Yes.
And too many speakers in my language have chased me with a broom.
Yes.
And so I feel like that's part of the, and maybe there's a part of me that feels like, given that things aren't happening the way they're supposed to, right? We don't have these kind of multilingual, multi-generational families around us speaking our languages for all kinds of reasons we don't even have to go into. we do need to create these conditions for engaging with our languages. And I feel like sometimes there's a place for these Indigenous language texts in there, because on the one hand it sucks that we don't have the people, but when the people are there, then there's the dynamics, right? Whereas I can sit down with a Māori language text and I can go as slow as I need to, and I can pull out the dictionary as often as I need to, and it's I get to do it not on my terms in a selfish sense, but I get to do it with all my shame and all my slowness and all my, like, oh my god, I knew one word out of that whole line, you know, or whatever. And then you get there, and one of the things that I've enjoyed about the podcast episodes is hearing people who are not themselves fluent speakers yet be able to speak about the connections that they could have with a text from their own language.
Yes.
Do you know what I mean? It's like there's a kind of,
there's,
because it's just there, you get to connect with it.
Yes.
And that's about the richness. I mean, we like to tell these stories about, oh, we come from these very oral cultures, whatever, but I mean, there's something about the richness that enables that kind of time to collapse in a way that I think can be more of an uffy than a stick.
And I think I think it's also, it's good to not subscribe to that idea that you're, oh my god, I'm a failure, and then the language is going to come up to me with a broom, you know. But it's hard not to. And I think that's, people need to step, myself included. I mean, oh, I've got that mind that I really need to let go of. Stop looking at it as something that I will get punished for if I don't do it, and I have to be kinder to myself. And if I'm failing, I'm failing. So what? You know, just keep going. And I love the idea that the language would come and give you a hug rather than shake a broom at you.
Yeah.
And that is, for me, it's a lot more comforting, that it would hug you rather than shake a broom at you.
And part of it, I think, is that understanding the history by which these words were taken out of our mouths. And I think that's where, when you're talking about kind of reading through these pages of assimilation, right?
Yeah.
And, you know, because Te Aho is a magazine, I mean, that's... it's literally the voice of the government to the Māori people about this is how you can turn into white people. Like, that's pretty much how the, you know, it's, the idea is to usher us into a certain kind of assimilated, like, modernity, which is code for not that other thing.
Yeah.
And,
it's like, it's definitely, like, the main thrust, but it was subverted a lot more than I think the government would have wanted.
Totally.
Which is why it's, like, so interesting you have all these, like, kind of conflicting things next to each other. That's why, like, the poem is so many, there's so many kind of, like, contradictory lines, you know, like, there's silence, but there isn't silence at the same time.
Ooh, so much to think about, eh? So much. But I think my takeaway for me, thank you, Alice, is the language will hug you. Don't be too hard on yourself. Don't think of the brooms, although it's never far, but, you know, but I like that. And the text that you find with a project is doing that for me. The text is hugging me and saying, you know, be kinder to yourself. You live in a different world now. You're not in Fiji, not in Rotuma. You're here, so your experience will be different, and you can't say that it has to be the same here when you live in a totally different world. I feel good. Thank you, Alice. You know, Alice, you were talking about how you can sit down with a text and you can take your time and read through it. And when I wrote Writing Each Other, I did the same thing with the collection of mythology that was written by Titi Whanau Me Salama, which is also in the archives too. So I took out all those myths and I was looking for, and I painstakingly look for patterns of how they would start the story and how would they introduce the characters. So I kept underlining it and comparing. And then I found the patterns, and then I wrote the story, the second stanza, according to the patterns that were in Massive. So, you know, when you say how we can engage with this text that you're finding through the project, for me, that's a way that I can engage. Look at the language, compare the patterns. Yeah. How did they say it then? How can we use it now to write a poem?
What about that, Issa? You look like you have thoughts about that.
Yes.
I had a lot of thoughts, especially like the home, like the idea of homework, because I've been engaging with Māori Made Easy, Scotty Morrison's work book text thing. I don't know, I was joking to a friend last night because I'd forgotten to do it in the morning, so I was like rushing to like do the task for the day, like basically in the middle of the night. Yeah. And then I was just like, oh, I guess it's Māori made possible, I guess. Because it doesn't feel easy even with that. And,
it doesn't feel easy, or is it?
No. I had like a short text conversation with a friend that was all in Māori, and that seemed like way more rewarding in a way that just engaging with this text, because it's, you know, you're forced to have to use the tools to like communicate with someone rather than like having this almost like rote, like, and it's a very useful book and I'm very thankful for it, but there's like this sense that you're doing like these tasks. There's a lot of things where it's just like memorize these words, and I'm like, I thought you would give me the task to memorize the words. I guess I could just read them over and over again. But yeah, having this like short conversation, it was like over a long time because we're both kind of on a very, very similar like beginner level. Which is like half an hour later, then this like text and Māori comes. And it's like, okay, I'm gonna start deciphering this. But it feels really centering. It's really interesting how the language happens to the body.
Yes.
And how you feel like, you know, I feel like my body's different when I'm engaging with Te Reo Māori.
Yes.
And it's like that's a really exciting thing. Me, at least.
I should say that, you know, I went a bit nuts on like TED Talks and all that kind of thing about baby development when I was going to Tila. And I had listened to this one where they'd made this, they'd done this research and they found that babies cried differently depending on the language they'd heard in the womb, right? That French babies and Japanese baby, you know, the very different rhythms of speech they're surrounded by, which was great because there's enough you're already guilty about when you're carrying and you're like, one glass of wine, is it, you know, like all that stuff. And then I'm like, oh my God, what if my baby like cries like an English speaker? From the start, it's all over, you know? But it's a crazy thing to think about, right? This very first utterance is already so marked by colonial, like, language. Oh, my God. We haven't had a chance to count to 10 with it yet, and, you know. Yeah. Yes, I actually used to play. Totally. This baby's screaming like a podcast. And she, you know, and she, another poem in there, I'm sure. But, you know, I would like quiet myself and play heaps of Māori CDs and stuff, hoping that the child would have a cry to prove that, yeah, I don't know. I mean, it's just crazy, isn't it?
The things we do, yeah, what?
Yeah. Totally unnatural forms of, it's an unnatural form of language teaching, eh? Yeah. You know, this notion of endangerment, you know, I mean, puts us in a position where there can be, there's just so many ways to fail at being Indigenous, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
And so it's that kind of, you know, here's some more.
Here's some
I prepared earlier you might not have thought about before. Yeah, your baby might scream like a Pākehā. You know?
Start of a poem.
Failed again. There we go.
But it's like you were saying, as an Indigenous person, you do, you know, kind of have all these things that you've got to ensure because you take it upon yourself, the history of your people, the fights in which a whole generation of people, and the certain privilege that we have now to be in the in having stood on those many shoulders over the many generations, and our obligation to remember those things. So,
obligation.
And so it's like a bit of a self-paralysis at times. Because
you don't want to be the weakest link.
Well, that's right. Right.
Like, oh, it was fine until this
that's
way.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right. You know,
get it all down.
Well, absolutely.
Yeah.
But like you were saying, in the position, we've got to turn that position from the deficit point to say, no, we're doing all right. The broom is our friend.
The broom will sweep away the oppression of the devil.
Sweep away your self-doubts. Yes,
a nice broom.
Broom, just do this like a dust.
But you know, yeah, as an Indigenous person, seriously, and it's coming here to New Zealand, and I've talked about this, how I've seen how just what happens, my Indigenous self just grew here. But there are certain times when I feel the pressure to be, to achieve this and to achieve that. And I don't know whether that actually makes sense, but sometimes I do feel the pressure. You haven't done this, you haven't done that. You have, what's taking you so long to do this?
So what's the place of poetry in all of this? Like, why, at least for the three of us, why when we're having our, like, massive angsts and dramas and traumatic oppression, etc., like, what does a poem do in all that mix? Like, sort of, like, I'm genuinely asking, like, because I know that, like, when I was trying to, like, grapple with this last miscarriage and I was like, I'm going to write a poem. You know, like, that just seemed like the thing. And it wasn't just a, and a mihi to Jackie Stern, who parented under very difficult circumstances as a, you know, single Māori mum in Wellington, etc. So, you know, like, so what's, like, what is the poem? Where do the poems fit? Like, why do we do this thing?
For me, it's both, on a personal level. I engage with poetry on a personal level. It's the place I go to. I just don't want to hear all your problems. Leave me alone, because I have so much on my shoulders and in my head, and I'm going to scream, and an artery is going to burst in my body if you do not leave me alone.
See, the embodiment of language thing, we're back to there, yes.
Or I'm going to, something's got to happen to you if you don't leave. So poetry does that for me. It's it's the calming place. It's my little gazebo in a garden that I go to to sit down and say things that I can't say openly. You know, the place you go to have time for yourself and to think and to plot and to conspire and, you know, all of that. So it's my little space for me. But on the other level, where I'm trying to make it work for language, you know, That's how I see using poetry for part of the revival of Rotuman. But it's more a personal thing for me. It's my escape. Oh, yeah, it sounds like a cliche, but it is. It's where I run for my hug. Yeah, run for my hug.
The poetry hug.
Yes, the poetry hug. Bloody poets, eh?
Poetry, where language hugs.
They release their words to society, then they run to their refuge and watch the damage their words do. These bloody poets. They release it and then they retreat into their gazebos and watch what their words do. Oh, where?
My sister used to warn people. She'd be like, don't say anything to us. She's a poet and you'll hear it come back to you at a poetry meeting. And I'm like, yeah, but I always anonymize it where, like, necessary, but yeah.
Oh, same thing. Keep quiet, Mary's here.
In Ransack, the book, I wrote a poem about my mother and about, her being pregnant with me. And I remember one of the comments I got back from my supervisor was, it's a poem that consistently denies how you could have done this to your mother. But it was very much one of those things. I like didn't talk to her about it. Like I had asked her about, like, you know, yes, what happened and how, you know, everything went down, I guess. And then it, you know, just released it into the world, and I was like, oh, she might read it at some point. But I was like pleasantly surprised. I think like a couple of months later, she messaged me on Facebook and was like, "This is exactly the experience of, this was like what I went through, and you know, it really touches me that you like, you know, tapped into that." And so it's, I think sometimes poetry is like a spell. I think it's also, I don't know, it's so many things. It can be so many things. I'm very wary of saying poetry does this or poetry does this or that, because, you know, there's been a lot of people who've used poetry for, you know, not so savoury means. Just thinking of people like Ezra Pound and his, like, kind of his cantos for Mussolini. You know, poetry can, you know, like writing fanfic for a fascist, like, poetry can do a lot of things. But I think for me, poetry can be a space where you can make mistakes, and it's where language can slip. And for someone who doesn't have, you know, doesn't have a handle on, you know, their own language yet, it's a place where I feel like I can decolonize English. Because, you know, you don't have to write in sentences. What's a sentence?
Yes!
Punctuation, whatever.
And you can play with the words in a way that you might not be able to in other contexts. And, I like to think that my ancestors enjoy that. They're kind of like, play around with it. I don't know.
It's a spell.
But yeah, that place for playfulness, and like, but also like not just playful for like, oh, this is fun, but like actually kind of wrenching things apart and making English unfamiliar with itself.
There's a book by Julian Talamantes Brilaski called Of Mongrelitude, which is essentially this like whole idea of poetry and play as survival, and like, you know, we're here and we're surviving, and we can play with this language, just like, you know, these like Pakeha poets, and but, you know, it's like doing this kind of really important work of decolonizing language. But like, not to overstate, you know, it's still poetry. I was really, I think it was a review of the book where someone was like, this is poetry as play, but it's like absolutely important at the same time. I really think that's, I really like that idea.
I like that idea, poetry as play. There's a lot of learning that comes
from it, you know, because one of the things that really struck me with reading, you know, things like the early versions of Mana, the Fiji-based, you know, periodical, or you know, so many of this kind of poetry from this time period, people are like, this is a poem about the government, this is a poem about capitalism, this is a poem about, you know, I think Grace Mary Melissa's Blackstone is up there, you know, she's like, I'm going to talk about E Vanuatu, you know, like, let's go there, you know, and I wouldn't want to kind of set up this false, like, these identity stuff and these politics stuff, but I think that there's something really palatable for a mainstream audience sometimes, and like, they like to have natives who are feeling oppressed by the complexity of their own identity a little bit more than they like the natives who are like, hey guys, there's structural issues here, let's go, you know?
I feel like that's what happened with Alison Whittaker with Black Work, because we had a conversation where we were talking about, like, I've written all this stuff about identity, and it apparently hasn't been clear whose fault that is. You have to write all this stuff where it's like, it's your fault. Like the kind of like daring the audience to like and you know, have some feelings about what's going on, rather than just being like, you know, these, because I get these questions about like my pronouns and whatnot, which, you know, I think is important, especially, you know, like honoring people's identities, and especially in regards to gender. But, you know, like the conversation would, you know, be like, how do you feel about like how the, you know, trans community is coming along? And I'm like, well, we still live under this like really crappy economic system,
right?
That,
yeah.
You know, like, I don't know, like, I don't really want, you know, us to assimilate into. And there's like, yeah, all these ways in which identity and like weirdness of identity doesn't seem to disrupt like people's kind of views of the world. Because it's just like, oh yeah, that person can just be different, rather than like, you know, this is looking at this identity or like who you are is like kind of, I think a lot of the writers wanted to draw attention to like how the systems control this identity, or how you just have to be more and more blatant.
Yeah, yeah. And all of them are good conversations, but this is actually one that we don't, you know, that I cherish personally.
Yeah.
Power dynamics being what they are, we don't get these ones as often as we'd like always.
Yeah.
So we have to, you know, be deliberate about, you know,
yeah,
coming together and having the Indigenous conversation.
Oh yes.
Yeah. Yeah. Because, man, we're so complex. There's so much already
complex
to talk about.
Times complex.
Yeah.
Right?
Complex squared.
There's already, like, so much happening, you know. Yeah. It's good to get to talk about it.
I think you really enjoy listening.
Kia ora, Pinaka Bakalebu. Thank you so much to our amazing poets for your contribution today. Happy New Zealand Poetry Day. From here at Writing the New World podcast. For more podcasts, please refer to our Facebook pages, Twitter, and where you get your usual podcasts from.